It's a pleasure to be here this evening. It's good to see some old friends, Charlie Williams in particular. I haven't seen him in a while. Charlie, there's a rumor going around that one of your great grandfather, grandmother were monkeys. You believe that? No? Well, let's talk about that tonight. So why don't we douse the lights, and I've got a bunch of slides I want to show you tonight, and we'll talk about this thing about evolution or Genesis creation. Someone want to reach behind that projector and flip that button all the way up? Okay, good. All right, we'll start off with the definition of evolution. Can you hear in the back? Okay. Evolution, belief that all living things resulted by natural changes from lifeless matter with no supernatural intervention. It's supposing an ordering creative process. There are two basic theories, if you want to call them that, on how our planet and all biological forms arrived here. Number one, the first one is that they were created by God during a recent supernatural intervention into history. Or number two, that they originated at different times in the past and evolved to their present state during millions of years of natural selection. Now, both are theories in a scientific sense because no human observer ever saw and recorded the events. And no one can successfully demonstrate either event in a laboratory using accepted scientific procedures. Now, both theories fall then into the realm of human faith and thus qualify as a religious belief. You see, when you look up the definition of religion in a dictionary, it's a cause, principle, or system of belief held to with ardor and faith. You see, evolution is exactly in that position. You see, our belief in Genesis creation is in that position. Now, we make no apologies that it's based on faith. It says in Hebrews that God is pleased by what? Our scientific theories? No, it's our faith. And it's based on faith. But so is evolution. See, evolution cannot be proved in a scientific laboratory. No one has ever observed a parakeet change into a sparrow or an eagle or whatever. You can search through all the pages of scientific literature, and you can't find one species evolving into another, let alone lifeless matter coming into simple cell life. They spent hundreds of millions, thousands of dollars trying to take inorganic chemicals and form life. They've never been able to do it. Yet they think somehow it happened in the past. That evolution is a religion is seen in the quotes of Julian Huxley here, who is a famous evolutionist, in his book Evolution in Action. He says, "I find myself inevitably driven to the language of religion, for the fact is that all this does and up to something in the nature of religion. Perhaps we might call it evolutionary humanism." And that's what it is. It's a religion. Now, are people in favor of this religion? By and large, the public is not. In Portland, Oregon, a group of concerned parents examined 18 textbooks in the Portland, Oregon public schools. They found in these textbooks, which are primarily biology textbooks, 690 pages devoted to the religion of evolution, 3.5 pages devoted to Genesis-type creation. They then made a Gallup-type telephone survey. In fact, they call up George Gallup, who, by the way, is a Christian, and asked George Gallup how many phone calls they would make at random in a city the size of Portland, Oregon, to get a somewhat decent survey. And he says at least 200. So they made over 200 phone calls at random in the city of Portland, Oregon. And of those people who were queried on the phone, 70% favored both creation and evolution as being taught in schools. 23% favored teaching creation alone. So that you've got 93.5% wanted creation brought into the classrooms in some form. Only 6.5% wanted evolution taught exclusively. Yet 690 pages were devoted to evolution, 3.5 pages devoted to creation. So this means that 99.5% of the biology textbook material was written for 6.5% of the citizens. Now that's hardly fair play, is it? And when we're talking about, we're not talking about scientific facts. We're talking about systems of belief, religions. And evolution is religion. Over the past decade or so, evolution has come under increasing attack from all segments of the society. Astronomers, biologists, biochemists, and so on. Harper's Magazine, February 1976, an issue on Darwinism, evolution, how it just doesn't really answer all the questions and has got all sorts of holes in it. Norman Macbeth, a Harvard-trained lawyer, wrote a fascinating book in the Delta paperback book called Darwin Retried, and it's a devastating attack on evolution. As far as I know, I don't know if Norman Macbeth is a Christian or not, but from a lawyer's standpoint, he looked at evolution and found it sadly lacking. This has this attack on evolution has shown up in a decline in the belief of evolution among college students. To illustrate this, at the University of Northern Colorado, in 1968, a professor teaching World History I started to poll his class as to how many believed in evolution. And in 1968, 90% of the students in that class believed in evolution. He would do this year after year, and the last time I saw the survey was 1975. In 1975, it had declined to 48%. Less than half in 1975 believe in evolution. He was very concerned and said he was determined to double the amount of time he spends promoting evolution. What is promoting evolution doing in the world history class? I don't know. But that's what he said he was going to do. You know, your most dogmatic statements on evolution are usually found in high school textbooks. There's a high school textbook, which I'll quote. It says this: all reptobiologists have agreed that evolution of life on Earth is an established fact. That's what it says. Is an established fact. A college freshman textbooks are almost as bad as high school textbooks. Here's a college freshman textbook which says this: no serious biologist today doubts the fact of evolution. We do not need a listing of evidence to demonstrate the fact of evolution any more than we need to demonstrate the existence of mountain ranges. See, it's almost as dogmatic as a high school book. But these statements are bluffing. They're trying to bluff the student because they're not true. And either the authors are lying, they're bluffing, or they're ignorant, or all three. I'm not sure. But they're not true. Here's a serious scientist, Dr. John J. Grebe. Dr. John J. Grebe invented synthetic rubber during World War II. He's got over 100 patents to his name. He developed and invented styrofoam, saran wrap, and many other items while he was director of basic and nuclear research at Dow Chemical Company. Dr. Grebe is an outstanding Christian. He's offering $1,000 to the first person who will give one clear proof of evolution. So what is that high school textbook talking about? That high school textbook is just bluffing the student. There is no clear proof of evolution. See, it just rests on faith. He said no theory should have to wait 100 years for proof. He said, let's go, I've got the $1,000. But they've never collected $1,000 because they don't have any proof of evolution. Okay, let's look at another serious scientist, in this case an entomologist, Dr. W.R. Thompson. And Dr. W.R. Thompson is a Canadian entomologist, you know, bugs. And he was asked to write the foreword in the centennial year edition, that is the 100th year edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species. Now, it was first published in, 1856 or 7. So 1956 or 7 or 8, whenever it came out, the 100th year edition. The book publishers asked Dr. Thompson, they looked around the world, and they wanted to pick one of the most renowned biologists, zoologists, whatever, in the world, and they selected Dr. W.R. Thompson, a Canadian. They said, please write the foreword to the centennial year edition of Darwin's text. Bring the public up to date into what's happened the past 100 years. He says, okay, but I want complete freedom. I want to tell it like it is. They said, tell it like it is. He says, now, I'm not going to write a hymn to Darwin, H-Y-M-N. He said, I'm going to tell it like it is. He said, tell it like it is. So he takes about 24 pages, and you can get this. You can go look this book up in the Gallier collection. Go up and ask for the centennial year edition. If you got a couple dollars, Xerox those 24 pages, and it is fantastic. Because he ripped and tears evolution to shreds. I almost fell out of a chair in the library when I ran across this. Of all places, to find such a devastating, hard-hitting attack on evolution, and to find it in the centennial year edition of Darwin's Origin of Species, I just didn't expect to find it there. But listen to this one paragraph to give you a flavor of what Dr. W.R. Thompson thinks about evolution. And remember what the high school student read and that college freshman student read in those textbooks. As we know, there is a great divergence of opinion among biologists, not only about the causes of evolution, but even about the actual process. This divergence exists because the evidence is unsatisfactory and does not permit any certain conclusion. But boy, that isn't what the high school textbook said. It's therefore right and proper to draw the attention of the non-scientific public to the disagreements about evolution. But some recent remarks of evolution show they think this unreasonable. This situation where men rally to the defense of a doctrine they are unable to defend scientifically, much less demonstrate with scientific rigor, attempting to maintain its credit with the public by the suppression of criticism and the elimination of difficulties, is abnormal and undesirable in science. And I say amen to that. And he takes those other 20-some-odd pages and goes in a lot of specific examples, which shows that the evolutionists were just all wet. And really, I mean, there's actually, they really committed some crimes, as I'll talk about in just a minute here. But this thing about attempting to maintain its credit with the public by suppression of criticism and elimination of difficulties. I'll give you a personal example. A couple of years ago, I was quoted, I think, in the student newspaper here about my views on evolution. You know, and of course, I'm anti-evolutionist. And a committee of professors here at OU took it upon themselves that they had to form a committee to write a rebuttal. And so they wrote a letter to the editor in the form of a committee trying to put me down because I didn't believe in their religion of evolution. And, you know, there was... they couldn't do it in person. They had to form a committee to do it. But so they attempted to discredit me because I had the audacity to, in a public university to stand up and state I didn't believe in the religion of evolution. And that's really all it is. It's a religion of evolution. But quite often in scientific fields where when evidence is produced which doesn't fit evolution, you know what happens to it? It's pigeonholed in a filing cabinet or swept under the rug or thrown out into the trash can because it doesn't fit that religion. And there have been many, many instances of this. Okay, I want to convince you in the next few minutes that it isn't a few crackpots, few Baptists, few Christians, few fundamentalists who believe in evolution, but there are a wide variety of scientists. I don't know the background of these fellows, a lot of these guys, if they're Christians or not, but these are the scientists who do not believe in evolution. And these textbook statements, which I read a couple of slides ago, are absolutely untrue. Let's consider a Nobel Prize winner, biochemist Sir Ernest Chain, co-holder of the 1945 Nobel Prize with Fleming and Florey for the work on penicillin. He strongly criticized evolution in the Robert Wiley Cohen Memorial Lecture of 1970. He stated the notion that man is about to be able to compete with God in creating simple cell life is absurd and not to be taken seriously. He called the Darwin concept of evolution a typical product of a 19th century euphoric attitude that science could solve all the secrets of nature. Regarding survival of the fittest, he scornfully points out it is nothing but a truism and not a scientific theory to say that living systems do not survive, they are not fit to survive. He added, these classical evolutionary theories are a gross oversimplification of an immensely complex and intricate mass of facts, and amaze me are swallowed so uncritically and readily by so many scientists without a murmur of protest. You see, the reason a lot of people, including scientists, believe in evolution is because a lot of people, including scientists, believe in evolution. That's right. You go along with the crowd. Let me see what happened here. Let's consider a European, Pierre Grasse. He's probably the top zoologist in Europe. Wrote a 28-volume set on zoology. His most recent book was an attack on evolution, the entire book just blasting evolution. The purpose of the book was to destroy the myth of evolution. The top zoologist in France. In the closing sentence of his book, he says it is possible that in this domain, speaking of the domain of evolution, biology, impotent, yields the floor to metaphysics. In other words, biology can supply no answers and must yield to the supernatural for an explanation of the origin of living things. It's interesting that the two countries where evolution has been swallowed almost hook, line, and sinker in the 20th century, but fortunately in America things are changing, has been United States and Russia. Now, you can understand Russia, of course. That fits their whole philosophy, communism, atheistic communist, beautifully. There is no God. We all evolved from a blob, you know, and so on and so forth. That fits evolution. Yeah, they like that. And United States, you know, I think it's just the reason United States, I think, has gone for it is Satan, I think, has really set his sights on United States, and he has done all he can to destroy it, just to destroy the voice and that we had for Christ in this country up until the last century and in this past century. You know, Satan has been tremendously active in destroying the American faith in Jesus Christ. He's taken churches which were once on fire for the Lord, which preached the gospel. He's taken these churches and thrown them off course by getting their seminaries and their preachers and so on off on the sidetrack of evolution. They started doubting Genesis and the rest of the Old Testament. They started doubting the virgin birth of Christ. Today, all they are Sunday morning social clubs. You can go there, be well-dressed, and hear the latest report or interesting article out of Reader's Digest or something like this. But as far as preaching the gospel, hundreds of thousands of these churches don't do it. And many of them, I believe, were thrown off track by evolution and Darwinism. And so Satan has, you know, has accomplished quite a bit in this because of this one theory. Many hundreds of thousands, millions of people have gone to hell because of evolution. Because maybe as a child, they were brought to church by their parents, attended Sunday school, whatever. They went to school. They started getting introduced to evolution. They said, well, that's foolishness, that church stuff and so on, and gave it up. And many of them, you know, were never saved and wound up in hell. Okay, another biologist. In a later edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species, published 1971, L. Harrison Matthew, fellow of the Royal Society, top-notch scientist, biologist in England, he wrote in his introduction of Darwin's Origin of the Species, on page 10. He got off talking about the centennial year edition where Professor Thompson criticized evolution. He says, much of Professor Thompson's criticism of Darwin's text is unanswerable. The evolutionists have no answer. It's been out 15 years, see. In accepting evolution as a fact, how many biologists have paused to reflect that science is built upon theories that have been proved by experiment to be correct, or remember that the theory of animal evolution has never been thus proved? He says it's never been proved. You know, and supposedly science is built upon this premise that you go to a laboratory, you run an experiment, check out the theories. But it's never been done in biology as far as evolution is concerned. He says animal evolution. I might add in the parentheses, evolution is in the plant world is even in worse shape than animal evolution. The fact of evolution is the backbone of biology, and biology is thus in a peculiar position of being a science founded on an unproved theory. Is it then a science or a faith? This is a biologist asking this. Belief in the theory of evolution is exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, but neither up to the present has been capable of proof. And see, this is what I said at first. I make no apology. See, I can't go in and prove to you absolutely, completely that God created the earth in 6 days and all these things that said in Genesis, that's how he did it. Now, I have faith that he did, see. I know that he did it inside. I have faith that he did it, but I can't prove it scientifically. You see, because to prove it scientifically, you have to have a human observer there to observe it, record it, and see it. Now, there was none there, see. Except after Adam, he came along kind of late in the week, see. So we have no... You know, and he didn't record it. And so we have no human observers. So when you think about it then, that forever no one can prove origin scientifically because we have no human there to see it and record it. Now, you can make speculations about the dating of this rock or that this thing, but those are all just speculations. It's not proof. So you can never be absolutely sure scientifically how it happened. See? So what does it mean? It rests on faith. So what you do is you collect evidence to support your faith, but it's still faith. But don't give up. See, we have a tremendous amount of evidence on our side. The evolution has got mostly hot air and hogwash. And it's getting to the point now where they won't even debate about it. They run and hide. Most recently, Dr. Henry Morris and Dwayne Gish tried to engage Dr. Fox and one or two others down at the University of Miami. Fox is one who's done quite a bit of work in biochemistry and in his so-called origins of life experiment. He has not developed life in a test tube, but he had some protein blobs which he thought he was on the right track or something, and wrote a lot about it. But Dr. Henry Morris and Dr. Dwayne Gish, who are with the Institute for Creation Research out in San Diego, tried to line up a debate. Fox said he would do it. And then Fox started getting letters from evolutionists all around the country begging him not to do it, because they said if he enters that debate and gets beaten, it's really going to look bad for evolution. Because a lot of these evolutions have already been beaten all around the country by men like Dr. Morris and Dr. Gish. Every debate they've been in that I've read about, and I've seen a couple of them, they beat the socks off the evolutionists. So this Fox finally backed out. And this guy is supposedly one of the top men in evolution in this country, and he backs out of the debate with Dr. Morris and Gish. So that shows you the position they're in. They're on the run. Our good professor here, L. Harrison Matthew, got off talking on page 11 here about the peppered moth experiments. Now, if you've ever taken a high school course in biology, there's about four or five things that they whip through on you that they try to prove, quote here, evolution. And one of them is the embryological recapitulation, which we'll talk about in a minute, and vestigial organs, and the peppered moth. Okay, what about the peppered moth? Well, he says the pepper moth experiments beautifully demonstrate natural selection or survival of fittest in action, but they do not show evolution in progress. What's he talking about here? Well, in England, before they cleaned up the dirty air, I think it was 1952, 100, 200 people died in London because of a bad smog. And it was caused primarily by, it was weather conditions and all the carbon and soot in the air from burning coal. So England started a program of taking some of the carbon and material out of the smoke, cleaned up the smokestacks. Prior to that, though, the tree trunks were very dirty and black because of all the black smoke. Now, there's a peppered moth over there, which has a light, an intermediate, and a dark form. Now, this one's kind of hard to see in this black, dirty tree trunk. The birds have a hard time seeing them. But this is easy to spot, so the birds would spot this one. They swoop down and eat that light one. The dark ones, fewer of them were consumed, so their population increased. Then when England cleaned up the smokestacks, the tree trunks became lighter or grayer. Then the birds could see this. This one was easy to see. And they started eating more of the black ones. So the population shift, you know, light to black. And an article appeared in Scientific American about 10 years ago by Professor Kettleworth, and it's a ridiculous article. 10 years ago, Kettleworth is saying At last, we've got proof of evolution. I mean, he admits that up until 10 years ago, there was no proof. He says, at last, we've got proof. And he says, this is proof. But what does Professor Matthew say? He says, no, that's not proof. He says, all you've done is change the population. You know, but there's no, that's the same moth that is today as it was 10 years ago, as it was 100 years ago. There's no, that's just the same moth. There's just more white ones or less black ones, whatever. It's the same moth, though. It hasn't evolved in anything else. And yet, people are confused by little things like this and to believe in, hey, that's evolution. And it's just pulling the wool over your eyes. It's not evolution. The other trick they'll try to put on you in high school is to show you these. How many people have seen these pictures in your high school biology book? Yeah, probably a third of the classroom. You know that the guy who drew these pictures was convicted in court for drawing the pictures because they're wrong? He fraudulently forged phony details in those pictures to try to show evolution? Ernest Haeckel. He was convicted at a Jena University court of fraudulently forging details on the embryo, development of a human, a pig, a cat, or dog, or whatever. And he tried to make a big deal. He said, hey, you can watch these embryos develop, and they've got gill slits at one stage, and they've got this, and they've got that. And he said, while they go through the process of fish to reptile to whatever, see, bird, man, monkey, whatever, dog, cat. And supposedly evolution says their ancestors were way back there, were fish, and then they became reptile, then they crawled out of the lakes and seas and became monkeys or whatever. And supposedly, then his theory was called embryological recapitulation. In other words, he says the embryo, if you watch the embryo of any of these animals develop, it goes through the process of fish to reptile to whatever it's going to become. And Darwin in his day thought this was the best proof there was for his theory. But then we discover our good Professor Haeckel was involved in Watergate and that he cheated on the drawings. Well, the courtroom trial took place in Europe, and it was rather, wasn't much publicity given to it. And as far as I know, word didn't reach America until about 40 or 50 years later that Haeckel had forged these drawings. And by then, let me go into a little more of the history here. But I guess it wasn't until 1930s or 40s that they learned in this country that Haeckel had forged those things. Haeckel confessed in the courtroom, a small percent of my embryonic drawings are forgeries, those namely for which the observed material is so incomplete or insufficient as to compel us to fill in and reconstruct the missing links by hypothesis and comparative synthesis. I should feel utterly condemned were it not that hundreds of best observers and biologists lie under the same charge. In other words, everyone does it, so why are you picking on me? And this is called science. And so it fools millions of people, you know, to believe, hey, boy, he's really got the proof. But Haeckel also believed in spontaneous generation. That is, you can put a bunch of rags and wheat in a corner of a barn, and you know what happens? Rats form. That's right. He believed in that also. Because he said if he didn't believe in that, you had to believe in a creator. And he didn't want to believe in a creator, see. So he just believed in spontaneous generation. Well, this embryonic recapitulation, see, it caught hold and swept over to America. People thought, hey, boy, he's got the evidence. A lot of churches and seminaries started doubting Genesis. But embryologists, scientists working in the field, looked for these things that Haeckel said he found. They couldn't find them. By 1920, 1930, most embryologists would admit, it's a good theory, but really there's not much proof for it other than his drawings. We can't see it. And you talk to an embryologist today, and they'll tell you, it was a good theory, important theory at one time, but it's not really true. And yet, why was it in your high school textbook? Did your high school textbook tell you it was not true? Did your high school textbook tell you that it were forgeries? That qualified embryologists don't believe it? No, because high school textbooks scrape the bottom of the barrel to make you believe in their religion. It's a false. It's a lie. You've been lied to in your high school biology book over and over again on this thing about evolution. Here's another one they lied to you about in your high school textbooks, vestigial organs. At one time, this is about 100 and some odd years ago, medical doctors thought there was over 180 useless organs in your bodies that were left over from the time that we evolved from monkeys or something else. See? But then as medical science found out more about the true nature of the human body, they find they had to keep erasing from this list. Today all that remains is a small handful. And I would be willing to bet within the next 10 or 20 years that handful will be erased too. Some of the recent deletions from the list include tonsils. They now know they supply phagocytes to the mouth and pharynx to destroy certain harmful bacteria. The thyroid gland used to be thought to be vestigial. They now know it regulates extracellular calcium and phosphate. The thymus gland was thought to be vestigial. The appendix was the very epitome. Well, you don't need your appendix? So what if you had appendicitis and taken out? You don't need it anyway, see. It's useless. It's vestigial. You, when you were a monkey, you know, they needed it, but now you don't need it. But they now know it plays a part in control of intestinal flora. It fights disease in the intestinal tract. Sure, you can live without it, but you're probably better off with it, see. You can live without one arm, but you're better off if you get two arms, see. The Cossack bone. It's a fusion of four small vertebrae into the tailbone. They thought, well, this is the leftover tail when our ancestors were monkeys. But now they know it serves as the structure, as the attachment for a muscle, which is used eliminating waste from our large intestines. It's a part of our structure in our body, which is useful. On and on it goes. But do you know high school textbooks list most of those which I just showed you? High school biology books list the appendix, the thymus gland, as vestigial organs. These are high school textbooks published in the past couple years. Now, those textbooks are new enough, they should have picked up on this. This stuff has been around now for several years. They should try to keep up with medical science instead of just turning the other way when they see data which doesn't fit the theory of evolution. Just leave it in there, you know. We got to convince the masses, you know, that our religion is true. So what if it's a lie? Now, Dr. Enoch, who's a zoologist, has noted there is a complete lack of nascent organs in the living world. What is a nascent organ? It's the opposite of a vestigial organ. A vestigial organ is supposedly an organ which is left over from the evolutionary past. We don't need it any longer. We've evolved to a state that's useless. A nascent organ is an organ which supposedly is evolving now, developing, you know. Maybe we should be developing a third lung if the air is so polluted, as they try to tell us, you know. Or a third eye to see through the polluted air. Why don't we see these things evolving? See? Well, he says we don't see them in the living world. Has evolution stopped, you know? He says, well, in fact, you look in the fossil record, and there's none in the fossil record. So there's no evidence for these developing organs has ever been found. So where's your evolution? This thing about spontaneous generation. As I said, many people believed in the past that rags and wheat in a corner of a barn produce mice, algae and slime on a pond produce toads and frogs. You just put them together and that's what happens, you know. Spontaneous generation. That seems ridiculous, but we got spontaneous generation believers today. Well, you just take some ammonia and this and that and some other chemicals, put them in a test tube, life comes out. They say, I'll prove it to you. Give me $1 million, $500,000 from the government. So let's get some from our taxpayers and go spend millions of dollars in laboratories and they can't find it. Well, we'll find it on Mars. So they take millions of dollars in the space program, put all these probes and send them to Mars. Going to find life on Mars. Can't find it. I was in a space program from its inception in 1959 and 58 at McDonnell. We first built the Mercury capsule. And I know that the driving force behind a lot of our space program were biologists at NASA trying to prove that life evolved. And they just wanted to send all these probes all over the solar system and show that there's life in outer space and so on and so forth and that Earth is not unique and whatever. You know, they've never found it. In fact, if we got time, I'm going to show you that there's been a tremendous amount of data from our space program which embarrasses the evolutionists because they show, for example, they indicate the Earth is very, very young, the solar system is very young, and these billions of years the evolutionists talk about are not there. And so most of the data we've gotten from the space program is an embarrassment to the evolutionists. Francisco Redi demonstrated this thing about spontaneous generation. He said, look, let's take a bowl with meat in it, no cover. You let it sit outside for a while, a couple weeks, whatever, and there's maggots in there. Take a bowl with meat in it and cover it tightly. Same period of time, take the cover off, no maggots. He explained why. Flies lay eggs in there, and those eggs and they start developing, that's the maggots. So he says, life begets life. And that's been all our experiences. That's what the Bible says. See, it doesn't just happen, except for the creation week. Louis Pasteur, who's a hero of mine, he also showed similar things. He argued with these people about spontaneous generation life. He says, look, and he ran this experiment. He took a broth, sterilized it, and he corked it. And the broth remained unchanged. Didn't change color, cloudy, anything. Took the same type of broth, sterilized, heated it, but left it uncorked. After time passed, it became cloudy with bacteria. Where'd that life come from? He took same broth, he sterilized it, heated it, stored it in a swan's neck flask, left it for the same period of time, no life in there, no bacteria. And Pasteur explained, this is what happens. When we put the cork on there, or we put the swan's neck flask, a little bacteria floating around on the dust particles can't come down in here and increase their population. Or in swan's neck flask, they drop down to this little elbow here and settle out here and can't get up into here. But this left open to the atmosphere, the bacteria enters, gets in that broth, multiplies, and you got all this bacteria in there. So he says, life begets life. Another scientist argued with him. This one guy, this one priest, what was his name? I forgot his name, but he argued with Pasteur. He said, well, if the air has all of these bacteria in it, he said the air would have the density of lead. You know, he says, obviously there's nothing in the air. And so you argue with these guys, but these were experiments that Pasteur did. Various gases, like methane and hydrogen and ammonia and nitrogen and water. And if you mix these things up, we think maybe that we can form life. And so there's been a lot of speculation that the ancient Earth's atmosphere had methane gas and hydrogen and ammonia, and that these gases are really what formed life. Maybe a bolt of lightning or something hit him. You had heat and little protein molecules formed or something. Well, Dr. Sidney Fox, the guy who backed down from the debate with Dr. Dwayne Gish and Henry Morris, heated a few amino acids together, and he formed these sort of random sequence, which he called proteinoids. He said, hey, these are the forerunners of life. Just got a blob there, you know. He said, this is it. I'm almost there. So he goes to NSF, gets a few more $1 million for his next experiment. And S.I. Miller, similar type thing. He put electric discharge, so ammonia, methane, and water, got some protein-like blobs out of it. Hey, I'm almost discovering life, you know. And that gives him a few more $1 million, $100,000 on more experiments. The other guys did similar things. They would take DNA molecules from a living virus, put in some other material with it, and this DNA molecule from a living virus would replicate itself. They say, hey, look, we've almost created life. But they had to start with DNA molecule from a living virus to start this thing. They didn't start with inorganic chemicals. And none of these experiments have. Oka and Kornberg, similar type thing. DNA molecules from a living thing, enzyme molecules, and these things would get more DNA. And these guys, oh, we're almost on the verge of creating life. I remember about 20 years ago, or it was the 1960s, I guess it wasn't quite that long ago, it was one of these experiments that came out, and these guys would say, hey, we're almost on the verge of creating life. President Lyndon Johnson came on television and made the announcement that life is being created in the test tube. And it was absolutely false. Yet, people are left with a lot of people have the impression that life is being created in the test tube. It is not. Geochemist Abelson, the director of the geophysics lab at Carnegie Institute in Washington, says there is no geochemical evidence for a primitive methane ammonia atmosphere. And that's what these guys have always assumed, that you got methane ammonia and you put electricity in it and the lightning, whatever. He says, but there's much evidence against this type of atmosphere. Dwayne Gish says that Fox's microspheres and other things that they created in their test tube, he says, for those to be converted to tiny molecules of life cell into a living system by chance, he said, an ocean of small molecules so large that the world cannot contain them would be needed. He says, you know, just looking at pure chance, you couldn't have enough of that stuff. The obstacles against life from a primeval soup are three. The Earth's atmosphere, by most observers, believe that it contained oxygen, which would have oxidized the organic chemical compounds, and they would have been useless then. However, if there had been no oxygen in the atmosphere, if there had been none, then any life form would have been destroyed by the sun's unfiltered ultraviolet radiation, which ruptures the chemical bonds in protoplasm. Life exists on Earth today because we are shielded from direct ultraviolet radiation by a high-level blanket of ozone. So that if you got the oxygen, it oxidizes these chemicals, and you can't make any protein-like molecules out of them. If there is oxygen, you allow the if there were no oxygen, the radiation would come through and destroy them. So they're caught between a rock and a hard spot. And the probability against formation of the smallest living cell by pure chance, taking a bunch of random proteins and putting them together, is at least, has been computed to be at least, 1 followed by 119,845 zeros to 1 against it. That's against forming the smallest living cell by just random chance putting these protein molecules together. And there was a biochemist who was also an expert in mathematics of probability, ran those calculations. Let's look at fossil gaps, some other strong arguments against evolution. Now, a lot of people think, hey, we're getting a fossil record. That's their strong point, isn't it? No, it's not. Fossils are one of their weak points. Dr. A.H. Clark says, no matter how far back we go in the fossil records of previous animal life on Earth, we find no trace of any animal forms which are intermediate between the various major groups or phyla. Professor John Klotz says, in what is known as the Cambrian period of life, there is literally a sudden outburst of living things of great variety. Very few of the groups which we know today were not in existence at the time of the Cambrian period. Dr. Dwayne Gish says, there is not one bona fide transitional fossil between invertebrate and invertebrates, fish and reptile, or reptile and bird has ever been found. Not one bona fide transitional fossil. Now people's, you know, in other words, he's saying, where are all these things with half fin, half legs, or three-quarter fin, quarter legs? There should be millions of them in a fossil record. If evolution is true, they don't find one. Even Darwin was worried about this. He says, why, if species have descended from other species by gradation, do we not everywhere see innumerable transitional forms? Why is not all of nature in confusion instead of the species being as we see them well defined? In other words, why is it when you came in tonight, you saw that animal down the street, you say, hey, that's a dat. That's half dog, half cat. No. You know, even a three-year-old kid knows a cat from a dog. You know, they got very distinguishing characteristics. They're easy to recognize. Now, he might be a boxer or a dachshund, but a kid, you know, little kids can, and they know what dogs are and they know what cats are. But why is there all kinds of confusion between the animals if evolution was true? You get your well-separated species. All the dogs could have come from one pair of dogs. All the horses from one pair of horses. All the cats from one pair of cats. And so on. And so all the pigeons from one pair of pigeons. Created during creation week. And today we see they're well-defined. Now, Herbert Nielsen in Lund University wrote in 1925, "My attempt to demonstrate evolution by an experiment carried on for more than 40 years. He started in 1885 to prove evolution by experiment. He said it's completely failed. It is not even possible to make a caricature of evolution out of the paleobiological facts." That is the fossil record. "The fossil material is now so complete, the lack of transitional series cannot be explained as due to scarcity of material. The deficiencies are real. They will never be filled. The idea of evolution rests on pure belief." What is a high school student taught? It's fact. Lauren Isley, anthropologist, wrote in Immense Journey, 1957, "With the failure of these many efforts to create life, science is left in an embarrassing position of having to postulate theories of living origins which it could not demonstrate, of having to create a mythology of its own, namely, the assumption that what could not be proved to take place today had, in truth, taken place in the primeval past." You can't prove it today, but they assume it took place in the past. Now, sometimes people point to this fellow, and you'll see pictures of him in biology books. They say, "This is a missing link. Archaeopteryx. He was a bird. They found skeletons in South America. He had teeth." And they said, "Therefore, he's a link between reptile and bird." Well, is he really? Dr. George Sutton, here at the University of Oklahoma, I asked Dr. Sutton about him. He's a retired ornithologist here, and he's world famous. He told me that the Archaeopteryx is a highly developed bird, certainly not an emerging species. He says, for example, it has a foot of a perching bird, which is supposedly one of the most highly specialized of all things in the evolutionary progression of birds, if they did evolve. But supposedly the perching foot is supposedly highly evolved, yet it has it. So this could be a link between a reptile and a bird. You take their own data and use it against them. They say the perching foot came late in the evolution of birds. Archaeopteryx has a perching foot, therefore he's not a link between reptile and birds. He's simply a species of birds that had teeth that God created and are now extinct. I mean, there are millions of things which once lived which are now extinct. Dr. John Moore, a friend of mine at Michigan State University, who's written quite a lot in this area and debated and lectured in this area, he said groups of both plants and animals appear suddenly in the fossil record. For example, most mammals appear suddenly in the so-called Eocene division and are as diverse then as researchers find them today. Whales, bats, horses, primates, elephants, hares, squirrels, and so on are all as distinct at their first appearance as they are now. There is not a trace of a common ancestor, much less a link with any reptile, so on and so forth. Dr. John Moore had some of the students, one of his classes at Michigan State University, go over and take the magazine called Evolution, and which supposedly writes up on the research of people doing research in evolution. He had them go through the entire volumes of it, look through every issue, and find out what sort of bug, fly, bird, whatever virus that the researcher started with in his experiments, and find out what they ended up with. And do you know what they ended up with? Not in most cases, or in some of the cases, but in every case, they wound up with the same bug, virus, whatever, that they started out with. There was not one proof of evolution. Yet they spend, wasted millions of man hours, dollars, and so on pursuing this false religion. Taxpayers pay for most of it. Now let's talk with one of the top evolutionists in the country, George Gaylord Simpson, Harvard University, on this question of the fossil record. What does he say about it? He said the sudden appearance of complex life has prompted Dr. George Gaylord Simpson of Harvard University to call it, and this is what he says, the most puzzling feature of the whole fossil record and its greatest apparent inadequacy. In other words, a fossil record doesn't do us evolutionaries 25 cents worth of good. You talk with a lot of these guys about fossil records, you know what they'll tell you? They'll say, well, look, we really don't have proof for it in a fossil record. But you know where to go to get proof for it? Go to the biologist. Go to the biologist and say, hey, now show me your proof of evolution. Now say, look, we really don't have it, but you know where you can go find it? Go to the paleontologist and talk about fossils. They've got it. And you go around in circles looking for it. They keep sending it to the other guy because they don't have it. Dr. John Moore says there is absolutely no experimental evidence for any change of one animal form to another animal form, or for that matter, any change of one plant form to another plant form, such changes being those demanded according to the general theory of evolution. The only evidence of change that can be classed properly as a result of sound scientific method is the evidence of genetic variation within limits or kinds or forms of animals, or within limits or kinds of forms of plants. Now, no one argues. See, you can take corn, and you can grow one type of corn. You can grow sweet corn. You can grow horse corn. You can take roses, and you have all different varieties of roses. You can breed them, you know, but you can't turn a rose into a daisy. If there's a genetic boundary, you can't do that. Everyone in this room doesn't have the same color eyes, hair, skin, whatever. There's genetic variation within humans. There are black humans, brown humans, but we're all descendants of Adam. And furthermore, we're all descendants of Noah and his children. We're all from the same family. We can't go past these boundaries, see. They're apes, and apes have certain boundaries. You can't breed man and apes. You get something half man, half apes, see. Now, this fellow took horses, and he bred horses down to the size of a collie dog. And you can breed horses up to the size of a giant Clydesdale, but they're still horses. You turn them loose in the wilds, in the woods, and these things will eventually, if they don't die off, because they can't compete with the larger animals, if they don't die off, they'll revert back to normal horses. And that's been the experience of all these experiments with fruit flies, various things. If you get something with a slight change, a little slight different wing or color, so on, if it doesn't die off and become weak, it will revert back after many population changes back to the original species. So where's your evolution? People talk about natural variations. They say natural variations and mutations. They said that's the mechanism for evolution, mutations. Well, some people argue that maybe only one out of 1,000 is beneficial. Others argue that none are really beneficial. A digital computer analysis by an engineer at MIT, a mathematician at the University of Paris, France, they both concluded in their analysis using computers that evolution is impossible. You can't use natural variation, mutation to produce anything new. They tried to produce a simple virus molecule on a computer, which could simulate 10, 20, 30 billion years from the so-called origin of life molecules. They couldn't get it, and they reported at a meeting with other evolutionists. Here was an electrical engineer, and here was a mathematician. This was in Philadelphia at a meeting there, and they reported their computer says evolution is impossible. The old biologist, the evolutionist, blew their stack. One got up, pounded the desk. He says, I don't care what your computer says. He says, you're wrong. He says, and the reason I believe in evolution is because we're here. In other words, because there's life, there's evolution. See, completely pushing out of his mind that God created him. That's what a lot of these people do. See, they want to push out of their mind that there's a God, which means there's a judge and a judgment coming. They don't want to think about those things. So any straw they can grasp which says there is no God, there is no judge, there is no judgment coming, I want to hang on that, see. And don't confuse me with the facts my mind's made up. That's what a lot of them are. Goldschmidt. Yeah, Richard Goldschmidt. Geneticist Richard Goldschmidt, University of California, Berkeley, top-notch geneticist. He tried for 20 years to prove the mutation theory of evolution by zapping gypsy moths with chemicals, radiation, and whatnot, to try to take these gypsy moths and produce something new. All he ever got was gypsy moths. Some of them weak, some of them puny, maybe a little longer wing or something, but they were still gypsy moths. He finally, after 20 years, you have to admire his fanaticism and his stick-to-itiveness, he gave up. He says, mutations don't work. They don't produce anything new. He still believes in evolution. Apparently, he's one of these guys that don't want to believe in God. He says, well, what happened? It was probably like this. He said, one day a dinosaur hatched an egg and a turkey hatched out. And, you know, the other evolutionists looked at him and said, well, you are the one who laid the egg, you know. And that theory is a turkey. And they fight among themselves as to who's right. Someone gets a call from McGraw-Hill book company, hey, we need a new high school textbook on biology and evolution. He said, sure. They've just been arguing about the mechanism. They don't know what it is, but what's he tell a high school student? All reptobiologists have agreed that evolution of life on Earth is an established mess. No, an established fact. So the student, the public, is not told the truth as to what's really going on in this science. The thing about mutations, there are sudden hereditary changes which arise due to rearranging material in the genetic code. They are nearly always bad or injurious to the species. They can remove structure or alter them, but they do not produce anything new. Earthworms don't get eyes, rabbits don't get wings. Natural selection is not permanent. When the stress environment, whatever it may be, the snow with the hunters and the bears or the penicillin with bacteria is relaxed, the population always reverts back to the original state. You've always probably heard this thing. Well, look, they say penicillin proves evolution. Well, we've developed a fly resistant to penicillin. Doesn't that prove evolution? Remove the penicillin for a few years, a decade or something. You know what's going to happen? That fly is going to revert back to the original strain of fly. It doesn't keep on evolving into something else. Gene Rostand, now, he wrote a book called The Orion Book of Evolution. He's got some good stuff in it, and up to a point. This guy is doing some real clear thinking, and listen to these very sharp, clear thinking he's doing up to a point. Is it really certain then, as the neo-Darwinists maintain, the problem of evolution is a settled matter? Personally, I don't think so, and along with a good many others. I must insist on raising some banal objections to the doctrine of neo-Darwinism, you know, another name for evolution. The mutations are in general either organic deprivations, deficiencies, loss of pigment, loss of appendage, or the doubling of the pre-existing organs. In any case, they never produce anything really new or original in the organic scheme. Nothing one might consider the basis for a new organ or the primary for a new function. No, decidedly, I cannot make myself think that those slips of heredity have been able, even with the cooperation of natural selection, even with the advantage of immense periods of time in which evolution works on life to build the entire world. I cannot persuade myself that the eye, the ear, the human brain have been formed in this way. And I say, amen. Boy, he's on the ball. Now listen to what he says. And how does he conclude this? Later he concludes, despite this rather disillusioned conclusion, it is of paramount importance that no excuse be found to cast doubt upon the fact of evolution itself. And I say, why? Well, because it's their religion. See, you don't want to cast doubt on anyone's religion. We can't prove it. You know, it doesn't make sense. It's ridiculous to think that it could have happened, but don't cast doubt on it. Richard Goldschmidt. I covered this. Goldschmidt and his hopeful monster mechanism. Mendelism. In 1866, Gregor Mendel published a paper that laid the foundation for modern genetics. His work was disregarded until about 1900. Darwin's theory demanded variation, but Mendelian genetics indicated that variations in offspring were not of new types, but merely the reappearing of types already present in the ancestry. And let me give you a quote on this. I well remember the enthusiasm with which Mendelian theory was received when it was first introduced to the scientific world in the early days of this century. We thought at last the key to evolution has been discovered. But as our knowledge of the facts grew, the difficulty of using Mendelian phenomena to explain evolution became apparent, and this early hope sickened and died. The way that Mendel cut was seen to lead to a cul-de-sac, a dead end. E.W. McBride, Professor of Zoology, Imperial College, England. The date of Mendelism embarrasses us considerably. It comes to pass that some biologists of the greatest authority in the study of Mendelian principles of heredity are led to the expression of ideas which would almost take us back to creationism. Horror of horrors. You got to believe in God. Dr. John Moore, Michigan State University, says, oh, all right, now look, you biologists. And he lectures the high school biology teachers quite a bit. He says, look, now, if evolution were true, we should take the chromosome number of various species. And look, as things evolve, you expect the chromosome number to increase. Well, let's see if this makes... We look in the real world and see if that's true. A fruit fly has got a 2N chromosome number of 8. Okay, that's a pretty simple form of life. An onion's got 16. A possum's got 22. Well, a possum must be more advanced along the evolutionary trail than a fruit fly. Tomato's got 24, so it's evolved further than an onion. And a pig has got 38, so that's more advanced than a possum. But a rat is more evolved than a pig. It's got 42. But we're ahead of both of them. We got 46. But unfortunately, a deer, mouse, and a skunk have got more than any of us. And a protozoa's got 1,600, so we ought to quit and go back to basics. And say, all right, let's consider the DNA. The DNA is a molecule which codes all of life. Surely if evolution were true, the simple forms of life wouldn't have much DNA molecule in them, would it? They're a simple form. You don't need much, right? Okay, if evolution were true, the amphotrophibian's got 84, and it's pretty simple. Yet it's got 84 DNA molecules in one, 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 9th is a billion. This is 1,000 billionths of a gram. It's got 84 molecules in it. A lungfish has got 50, a frog 75, a toad 3.7, a man's 3.2. So these things obviously are all evolved further than we are. But at least we're ahead of the cattle, carp, and the chicken. So in the pecking order of evolution, we can look down on these guys, can't we? Second law of thermodynamics. I'm not going to take time to go into this. This is about 3 months in a law, you know, in a sophomore junior course in engineering. But real quickly, in any ordered system, open or closed, there exists a tendency for that system to decay to a state of disorder, which tendency can only be suspended or reversed by an external source of ordering energy, directed by an informational program and transformed through an ingestion storage converter mechanism to the specific word required to build up the complex structure of that system. In a nutshell, you take all the brick, mortar, nails, and wood, put it in that corner over there, and the evolution would tell you, put it over there, let the sun shine on it. The sun's an external source of energy, and wait long enough, and those bricks, mortar, nails are going to turn into, evolve into a building. No, it won't happen. All our experience has shown it doesn't happen. The second law of thermodynamics says that systems left to themselves do not become more orderly, more structured. They just get more random, more they wear out, they rust out. And yet evolution tries to tell us it goes just the opposite. And through 100 years of experiments, we've never found anything which violates the second law of thermodynamics. Yet evolution tried to tell us that evolution does. Well, let's skip that over. I want to finish up with some things about the age of the Earth, and we'll quit. I got too many slides here. Left-handed, right-handed molecules, probability of forming, the probability of forming the E. coli bacterium, which is a very, very simple bacterium, arising from an equilibrium mixture of hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen atom by pure chance according to evolution. You look at the odds on it, as Dr. Kopich has done, it's the odds against that occurring during 10 billion years are 10 followed by 100 billion zeros. You know, so you don't hold your breath that it ever happened. So all of these things, look at evolution. When the mathematicians get a hold of evolution and start looking at the probability, they throw up their hands. They say, how could anyone, any intelligent person in their right mind, I heard this quote similar to this, how can any intelligent scientist in his right mind who looks at the odds believe in evolution? Their faith is incomprehensible. You got to admit that. Well, Edwin Conklin here, I got to read this one to you. Biologist, Princeton University, says the probability of life originating from accident is comparable to the probability of the unabridged dictionary resulting from explosion in a printing shop. You got the type and the ink flying through the air. It spells out A-A-D. How do you spell artifact? Gives you the pronunciation and definition. Then you get the next one. You know, that's possible, yeah. He says, but that's more probable than evolution. Let me get over to life. How old is the Earth? We'll get there in a minute. Her eyes don't go out. Okay, Grand Canyon. You ever been to Grand Canyon? Listen to the park ranger paid by your tax dollars tell you it's millions of years old? That's right. The federal government, most state governments, push evolution, the religion of evolution. And they push it in a lot of your state parks and national parks. Now, evolution model demands an immensity of time. They say the evolutions kick around numbers like 5 or 6 billion years for the age of the Earth. In fact, it's been evolving upward the last 100 years. 100 years ago, it was on a labor saying 100,000 or 500,000, and every couple of years it goes up. Now, the latest figure is 5 or 6 billion. But computers, everything have shown that not even 15 billion years is old enough to allow the simplest molecule to form by chance. Beginning written records only go back to about 2200 or 3500 BC. Everything beyond that is just pure speculation. So we really don't know anything beyond that. It's just pure speculation. There's no experimental data beyond those points. Now, for about the past 50 years, students have been taught that radiometric dating has proved evolution. The dating uranium, lead, these types of things can prove evolution. Well, is that really true? Well, let's look at it. The radiometric dating method, you got your various uranium, thorium, lead methods, rubidium, strontium, potassium, argon. There are three assumptions in all those. You've got a closed system, no daughter elements initially present. Now, they assume there's no lead present with the uranium. See, uranium will eventually turn to lead. They assume there's no lead initially present. How do they know? They don't. They assume it. They assume the process rate is always the same. They assume it's always the same rate that uranium turns to lead. How do they know? They don't. They just assume it. When you look at those assumptions, none of them are provable, testable, or even reasonable. I won't take the chance to go through them, but you can't prove or test any of those assumptions. Actually, you can test a couple of them because recently there was one that they have tested the idea of constant process rates. We now know that some of these radioactive process rates do change, as some experiments have done at the University of Pittsburgh a couple of years ago. That they do change. So these assumptions about they're always constant for billions of years in the past, we now know that is really a bad assumption. And they found some more evidence that free neutrons would come streaming through the air. If they hit a lead-207 atom and convert it into lead-208, then if you take some of those rocks with uranium and lead, you've got some lead-208 formed with a free neutron capture. Well, then the age that you get with this lead-208 in there is completely false. And Dr. Melvin Cook, who is a Nobel Prize medalist, and by the way, he's a Christian, wrote in his book that this free neutron capture is probably important enough to upset all these uranium lead methods and make them absolutely worthless. And I'll give you some evidence in just a minute which showed us how worthless they are. Yet a lot of people believe this stuff to be true. And then, yeah, this is it. An English engineer collected data from all over the world, including Russia, the Pacific, and so on, took volcanic lava which erupted in known historic times, like there was a volcano which erupted in Hawaii about 200 years ago. They took that lava, dated with uranium, lead, and potassium argon methods, and uranium, lead, potassium argon said that the lava emerged from the bowels of the earth about, I don't know, 2 billion or 1.9 billion years ago. Yet they knew it came out 100 years ago. I think it was 1848 or something like that, or maybe it was 1800. But Pompeii, about 2,000 years ago, the uranium test there said billions or hundreds of millions. In every case, not in most, but in every case, uranium, lead, potassium, argon was off by by billions and millions of years. Yet the stuff was only 100 years old, 200 years old, 2,000 years old. And that shows you how much those things are worth, which I think are worth about 5 cents. They've taken rocks found around bones, and they'll take the rocks and date them with uranium, lead, or potassium, argon, or rubidium, strontium, and you might get a billion years. It's, hey, billion-year-old bones found in Africa. This happened with Leakey. He found some bones, and he says they're million-year-old bones or whatever, and 2 million years old. They later sent the bones to UCLA, where they've got a radiocarbon method to date bones. The radiocarbon method said, no, these bones are not 2 million years old. They're 10,000 years old. Now, something's wrong when the rocks around it said it's 2 million, yet the bones themselves said 10,000. One of those methods is wrong. And I believe the one that's mostly in error is the one that dates the rock. Radiocarbon does have some usefulness, and if you know how to correct it, the numbers. So most people believe rocks are dated by radioactive methods, but most are not really dated that way because they've been found to be so untrustworthy. A lot of people, the geologists, for example, don't put any faith in dating by radioactive methods. Instead, they date by using index fossils. And index fossils are, in each stratum, they assume there's a certain animal or something, bug, whatever, that's characteristic in that period of time. If you find those in that rock, then that means that that bug lived in this period of time, so that rock is so old. In other words, if you find a trilobite supposedly lived 500 million to a billion years ago, so that rock is 500 million to a million to a billion years. If you find a trilobite in a rock, you can find them down in the Arbuckle Mountains. And what this is circular reasoning. Fossils are used as a key for placing rocks in the chronological order. Criteria for dating the fossils is the assumed evolutionary progression of life. The fossil record is used to prove that life has evolved from simpler to the more complex. The main evidence for evolution is the assumption of evolution. Circular reasoning. Okay, this ought to blow the minds of the evolutionists. Here's a piece of wood. Wood, is this type of tree, was supposedly formed during the Cretaceous period, age of the dinosaurs, 70 million to 200 million years ago. But it was found encased in Cambrian rock, and some of you guys have read geology, Cambrian period is supposedly the earliest period of life, 500 million to a billion years ago. Yeah, what is wood during in the Cambrian period? Wood trees were not supposed to evolve then. But then, if that wasn't bad enough, which means you got about a 300 million year old error in there someplace, they dated the wood and found it to be 4,000 years old. So what can you believe? And what I'm saying is you can't believe these rock dating techniques. They are, in my opinion, worthless, not even worth 5 cents. I've got a list of over 77 indicators which indicate the Earth is young. Not 5 or 6 billion years old, but young. I won't take time to go through all of them. Our oil and gas wells. We know what the pressures are in these oil and gas wells. The pressures in many cases are very high. And we can compute and find how long it's going to take for the oil and gas well to flow through the rocks. Turns out, based on the porosities of the rocks and the pressures in here, oil and gas well is not going to last for more than about 10 or 20,000 years. So if we don't get it out in the next 10 or 20,000 years, it's not going to be there. And because the pressures of these things are so high, close to what we call geostatic pressure, indicates the stuff has not been down there very long. So it has been down there for 2 million years, like Sinclair and Texaco and these other TV commercials try to make you believe. You know, one of them said, hey, this stuff's been down there for millions of years, we've got to conserve it, and so on and so forth. They haven't done their homework on fluid mechanics, which happened to be an area which I teach and did my research and my doctoral dissertation in flow through porous media. It couldn't be down there for millions of years. It would have vanished. It would have flown through it would have oozed through those pores in about 10 to 20,000 years, maybe 8,000. But it couldn't be there for over 20,000 years. So it's simply hogwash to tell people it's been down there for millions of years and so on and so forth. There are a lot of Christian geologists who believe, and other scientists who believe, that oil and gas are the remains of animals and fish, billions of fish and other animals buried in the muck and mud of the flood. Because oil and gas is organic. It's an organic source. They know you can take, for example, garbage meat scraps, vegetables, and so on, put it under 200-300 pounds of pressure, a couple hundred, I think 2,000-3,000 pounds of pressure, a couple hundred degrees Fahrenheit temperature, and you can take a ton of garbage and get 2-3 barrels of oil. So oil comes from organic material. And you've heard of the old concept of tiger in your tank? You may have a tiger in your tank out there right now. That is a saber-toothed tiger. I'll tell you what else you may have out there. You may have some little reprobates who were killed off in the flood of Noah. That's right. And did make it on board the ark. Yes.
Can we let some of the people go that need to go, and then the rest could stay that want to stay?
No, they can't leave. I'm just kidding. Yeah, I can go.
If there's some people that need to go ahead and go, just be, feel free to leave if you can. But
you want to embarrass me and insult me, go ahead. That's all right.
I just want to give you the freedom if you want to, if you want to go.
Okay. I just got probably about 4 or 5 more slides in through if anybody wants to stay. Okay, we'll try to whip these real quick. Okay, oil and gas deposits. Went through those. Helium gas in the atmosphere. There's a lot of helium gas in the atmosphere. And it comes, as the Earth moves around the sun, we pick up this helium from the sun's atmosphere. It comes to our atmosphere from the sun's atmosphere. And it's coming in at the rate of about 300 billion grams a year. Now, we know how much there is in the atmosphere. This is a mistake. It should be 3.5 × 10^15. This is 3.5 billion grams of helium in our atmosphere. Okay, and it's like a fifth-grade thought problem that kids used to be able to work in the fifth grade. High school seniors can't work now. Suppose you got $20 in the bank, and you're putting money in at the rate of $2 a month. How long have you been putting money in the bank? Well, you say $20 divided by $2 a month, and you get what? 10 months. And in this case, the money in the bank is helium, and it's 3.5 × 10^15. It's going in at the rate of 3 × 10^11 grams per year. Divide this into this, and what do you get? 10,000 years. So this looks like the Earth is about 10,000 years. This process has been going on for 10,000 years. So this is an indicator of the Earth's age. Solar system dust. Again, this is one of the things that their space program was bad news for the evolutionists. We started sending space probes around to Mars and around our solar system. We found out the solar system was very dirty. And you see there's an effect in physics called the Poynting-Robertson effect. And the basic is this. Sunlight has pressure. You put your hand out in the sun. You say, I don't feel any pressure. Well, our hands aren't sensitive enough, but there's a small amount of pressure from the sunlight when you're out in the sun. Now, over 20,000, 100,000 years, that pressure is enough to sweep the solar system completely clean of all the dust and gravel and grit out there. It should be clean if it's 100,000, over 100,000 years old. But it's dirty, so that indicates the solar system is less than 100,000 years old. Or else some horrendous catastrophe occurred in the past 100,000 years. Age of the moon rocks. Now, when they brought the rocks back from the moon, then the evolutionary scientists down at NASA come out with stuff, hey, these things are 2.2 to 8.2 billion years old. How do they know? Well, they ran potassium argon, uranium lead, rubidium strontium tests on it, which I've already shown you are absolutely worthless when you go out and take stuff you know the ages of, like volcanic lava, and it just gives you errors in the millions and billions of years. But that's what they use to tell the public that it's 2.2 to 8.2 billion years old. But right uptown in Houston there, Rice University up the freeway, Department of Geology and Space Science, and Rice University got a top-notch Department of Geology and Space Science. They say, hey, you guys down the pike there are all wet because those moon rocks were glazed, you know, and glazed moon rocks indicate that they were heated to very high temperatures to glaze them. And they had to be heated to at least 1,000 to 1,300 degrees centigrade. Okay, multiply this by approximately 2 to get Fahrenheit, 2,000 to about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And we know that potassium vaporizes, turns to gas, at 744 degrees centigrade, so you can't use potassium-argon technique, whereas if you use it, you would get a very, very old age because there'd be so little of that stuff in there. And rubidium boils at 688, so you see the stuff was heated to at least 1,000 degrees centigrade, so you can't use rubidium to date those things and use the rubidium-strontium technique, because if you did, you would get a very, very old age. Instead, their analysis shows it's like in the order of tens of thousands of years age. Same conclusion was reached by Dr. Melvin Cook, the Nobel Prize medalist. But our tax money pays NASA scientists to come up with the 2.2 billion and the 8.2 billion years old, tell us it's billions of years in age, helping to support the myth of evolution. Then they get more money and go off looking for life at Mars, waste more millions of dollars there. Then, if that isn't bad enough, let's look at meteor dust. We know that the Earth receives something like 14 billion tons of meteor dust every year from meteors. They come in, they burn up, we see they call them shooting stars, but the mass is still there. We don't lose the mass. It just turns to dust, the fine ash, and settles down to the Earth. They estimate we get 14 million tons of dust every year from meteors. And if the Earth is 5 billion years old, like the evolutionists say, at 14 million tons a year, we would have a layer of meteor dust on the Earth's surface 182 feet thick, extremely rich in iron and nickel. Well, where is it? nickel is a very rare element. Well, they ship different meteors down now than it used to, you know. Stalactites and stalagmites. Well, any kid in high school, when I went to high school, back in the 1940s, the Dark Ages, they told us that stalactites and stalagmites were hundreds of thousands and millions of years in age. Like, we went to Mammoth Cave, Kentucky on a high school trip, and they showed us these things. The U.S. Ranger told us how many hundreds of millions and hundreds of thousands of years those stalactites and stalagmites are. Proof of evolution. Earth has been here for millions and billions of years. Here's a fellow showing you some stalactites. You know, like, they're 5 or 6 feet tall. You know where he's at? It's not Mammoth Cave, not Carlsbad Cavern. He's in the basement of the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., which was built in 1923. If you haven't had the new math, you can figure out how old those stalactites are. Or if you have had it, maybe you can figure out. Carbon-14 was developed in the early 1950s, it was bad news for evolution, because things like oil and gas, which are supposedly millions of years old according to evolution, were dated as less than 50,000 years old. Dinosaurs were dating less than 50,000 years. Saber-toothed tigers were dating less than 50,000 years. These things are supposedly millions of years in age. So every high school textbook since 1950 tells the students about carbon-14 and all the fallacies of evolution that carbon-14 disproves. No, I wish it did. It doesn't. Never mentions, you hardly ever see carbon-14 mentioned in a high school biology book. Because someone might happen to go over to the library and look up carbon-14 and find these things out. So they just conveniently don't tell a student about carbon-14 because it's bad news for evolution. And so almost everything they found was dating as less than 50,000 years old. But then along comes the space program. We find out that Libby, who won the Nobel Prize for developing, made some wrong assumptions about the amount of carbon-14 in the upper atmosphere. And his assumptions were wrong. When we started shooting space probes up there, several scientists have gone back and corrected his original technique. And it's now called the non-equilibrium carbon-14 method. And so now, nuclear engineer Dr. Robert Whitelaw from VPI University published this list showing he went through Radiocarbon Journal. There's, I don't know, 15,000 radiocarbon dates. I guess it was 15,000 radiocarbon dates published in there, as 40,000, 30,000 tells where they found them. He went back and corrected them with a space age correction, found everything less than 7,000 years old. Now, another scientist, Dr. Cook, his calculations were off. He showed everything less than 15,000 years. So there's a little bit of uncertainty. I wouldn't say it's 7. It might be 15, but somewhere in that range. But Whitelaw's data shows everything less than 7,000 years. He found about 600 pieces of wood and trees that state between 6,500 and 7,000 years, and a big drop, an increase in trees, and a big drop 5,000 years ago, then a slow gradual increase. Mean and animal bones in North and South America, not too many 7,000 years ago, then a drop, then an increase. Same way in Africa and Eurasia, a big drop 5,000 years ago. Whitelaw says, hey, this is interesting. This indicates that in Africa and Eurasia, North and South America, all over the world, men and animal bones and trees were almost wiped out 5,000 years ago. See the big drop here? He easily concluded this is evidence for the flood of Noah. You take your Bible, count backwards in time. Where do you get the flood of Noah occurring? About 5,000 years ago. And he says because we don't find anything older than 7,000 years, he said this proves that life has existed on earth for only 7,000 years. And you get your Bible count backwards in time, and it's difficult. You can't be sure if it's 7, it might be 15 or 10, but you don't get 5 billion or 5 billion, you know. And you take your Bible and count backwards in time. So this is this is very strong evidence for Genesis. Look at this data. You take the book of Genesis, you look at the age of the patriarchs. We find all the patriarchs from Adam to Noah lived about 900 years on the average. Now that seems hard for us to imagine because our patriarchs only lived 70 or 80. But with Noah, at the flood right here, about 1600 and some odd years, 1666 from creation, the flood, Noah's son Shem was born 100 years before the flood. Shem only lived about 500 years after the flood. He lived about 600 years. Here's son Arphaxad, lived about less than Shem did, about 400 some odd years, half as long as his grandfather. On the average after the flood, the lifespan dropped off, and it dropped off exponentially. Some of you guys have had, and gals have had mathematics, you know about the exponential curve. It's the most fundamental curve that exists in science, the exponential curve. It was only discovered about 300 years ago. Most things in nature, in real systems, follow exponential curves. Here's the Bible. Data from the Bible following an exponential curve. That has a ring of truth about it. That didn't come from a book of fiction. And the lifespan of man went down to 70 years with David, and it's 70 years a day in spite of Medicare and Medicaid and everything our welfare government's trying to do for us. We can't live more than 70 on the average. And there's some additional theory behind this about the water vapor canopy blocking out the ultraviolet rays, and which probably, at least according to some gerontologists, think that man lived longer because of the increase in the ozone layer and the warm greenhouse effect. But that's another story for another time. Let's quit right here. I think I've just about exhausted this. Maybe we can take this up some other time to talk about Ape Men. So I've kept you too long. Enjoyed being with you, and thank you for inviting me.